The Germans are known for fine engineering.
But are their efforts enough to fix Europe's financial mess? From APM, American Public Media in New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm David Brancaccio. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Thursday, June 14th.
Coming up, a conversation with the president of the World Bank.
And what's the future of the business of Lance Armstrong after today? Just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Don't overestimate Germany's ability to fix Europe's banking and government debt crisis. That's from the German leader, Angela Merkel, ahead of the big meeting of the group of 20 top economic powers. The summit's this weekend, the same weekend that voters in Greece choose a government that could determine whether their country stays in the euro or goes. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London.
Germany is strong, said Merkel, but don't expect miracles. Our powers are limited. Merkel is clearly feeling the heat. The rest of the world is crying out for an end to Europe's debt crisis. President of the World Bank, Robert Zoellick, has joined the chorus. He told Marketplace Morning Report that Europe had signally failed to tackle the twin problems of government and bank debt.
As Europe has moved to the brink each time, they've provided some liquidity, often through the European Central Bank, but they haven't been able to deal with those fundamentals, and as they've done so, it's always sort of a day late and a euro short.
This week's long-delayed bailout of Spain's banks has failed to stem investors' fears. Spanish borrowing costs climbed again today. Analysts say the only real way out is if Germany stands behind the debts of other eurozone countries. Don't hold your breath, says Bob McKee of Independent Strategy.
The political complications in achieving that are great indeed, and it's no certainty that agreement will be reached that the debt crisis can be turned around.
Angela Merkel still argues that economic reform and austerity are still the best ways to deal with Europe's debt. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Borrowing costs in Spain have reached the highest level since the country joined the euro in 1999. That's in part because we're at another one of those make-or-break moments for Europe. Yesterday, I was in Washington to speak with Robert Zoellick, the president of the World Bank. And for today's Midday Extra, we're sharing our full interview. I caught up with President Zoellick at his office at the bank.
President Zoellick, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, let me start by asking you about the European debt crisis. There's the big election this weekend in Greece. What are your major concerns about that?
Well, you know, the eurozone has been an ongoing source of anxiety, not only in Europe, but for the whole international economy. And it's a combination of problems: sovereign debt, banking, for some countries, competitiveness. And while as Europe has moved to the brink each time, they've provided some liquidity, often through the European Central Bank, but they haven't been able to deal with those fundamentals, and as they've done so, it's always sort of a day late and a euro short. And so I think going into the Greek election, the question will be, will the next Greek government negotiate to stay within the eurozone with a sweeter deal? Will that be acceptable to the Germans and others? And then what are the ramifications of this for Spain and others that have problems with their financial system and debt?
Do you think the euro is going to stay together?
That's ultimately for Europeans to decide. I think it can. I think it would be healthier for the international system, but it'll require more and different actions than have been taken so far.
Now, you've just warned that developing countries far from Europe are at risk from this whole crisis. What are you asking them to do?
Well, start out with the fact that I think one of the things that many people are unaware of is over the past 5 years, developing countries have provided about two-thirds of global growth. So the supports to the system have come from emerging markets. But what we're suggesting is this: we're moving into a new and in some ways more precarious phase because we're 4 years into the crisis. Some of the politics in countries is running thin, starting to get some increase of protectionism, renationalization. And so we need to have developing countries prepare for the uncertainty. Many of them had stronger fiscal buffers. Their budget position was better going into the crisis. So it makes sense, if you can, to rebuild that to deal with uncertainty. To try to avoid having so much short-term debt that you have to roll over in a precarious position. And third, this is true for developing or developed countries, focus on the fundamentals. It may be infrastructure for productivity, it may be human capital, but those are the basis for future growth.
But if you're asking them to reduce their debt right now, isn't that going to make the global economy weaker than it is?
It depends on their overall position. Many developing countries actually started to run into a risk of overheating. They grew quite quickly, and so they needed actually to take some actions with monetary and fiscal policy. And again, we're not trying to suggest that they put the brakes on their economic expansion, but we're suggesting they have to be well prepared for eventualities that none of us can predict.
How do you think that the euro crisis has been handled from other power centers in Europe, from the United States, from all over the world?
Well, you know, to be fair, you don't really have a one governmental system in Europe. So the European project itself is having to invent as it goes. And on the one hand, there's a few countries, Germany being the principal one, that had taken actions in the past so that they have stronger credits, they've got stronger economies, unemployment is lower. And the Germans obviously are wary of trying to subsidize others unless they make reforms. That's sensible in terms of fiscal and structural reforms for competitiveness. But if you have countries like Spain and Italy that are making reforms, there's the question of whether Germany and others can do more to help them get through this difficult period. So what you've seen is an ongoing negotiation. And sometimes the negotiation moves to brinkmanship. And brinkmanship in a world of risk is dangerous.
Is it hard to keep all this stuff together? It's such a complicated problem, and there are so many different players in it.
Well, the world economy is complicated, but you could flip that. There's also great opportunity. You know, I work with developing countries. 10 or 20 years ago, people would have seen developing countries as the source of the problem, the source of charity cases. Now, developing countries are a source of growth and future potential growth. I mean, many people may be unaware that sub-Saharan Africa grew at about 5% a year for 10 years before the crisis. Hmm. It's pretty much returned to those sort of growth levels. So I think even as we're dealing with today's problems, we need to be trying to think of the structural reforms, trade, infrastructure, openness, human capital investment, so that we take advantage of an opportunity.
Well, what's the next big crisis, the next major problem that you're worried about once we get past this European debt crisis?
Well, that's a big thing to get past, but I think the other issue is the United States still looms very large in the world economy.
Our debt, you're talking about?
Well, I'm starting out with our economy, but then and I think that the key issue that people will be focusing on with the Congress, but also this president, and if he's reelected, or Governor Romney, about how to deal with what's called the fiscal cliff. You have a number of things happening at the end of the year that relate to the budget, relate to spending, relate to potential revenues, relate to debt. And I think these are very important not only for the U.S. economy, but for the United States' ability to lead globally. So about a month ago, the Australian Foreign Minister, Bob Carr, was in Washington, and he said something that stuck with me. He said, the United States is one budget deal away from restoring its global preeminence. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a good way of focusing on what the U.S. can do.
You are about to leave the World Bank. What do you think is the best use of funds since you've been here, and what's the worst or least effective?
Well, I think the point for the bank is we have different types of mechanisms. We fund the private sector. We connect with sovereign funds, invest in some of our equity funds. We do development for malaria and education and others. And I think the key is there's no silver bullet. We have to recognize the differences in developing countries, and we have to treat them as clients. And the most important thing is to recognize that financing is just one element, and increasingly what the bank does is share the knowledge and learning and experience pragmatically about what works and help countries build their markets, their institutions, and their capacity. So it's how do you connect funding with a broader development solution?
But has there been some big project that you're quite proud of that that you think is a model for the future?
I think we've done some very interesting things ranging from small community development projects in Afghanistan that get local ownership, which have had high economic rate of returns but also build stability, to an asset management company that we created with IFC, our private sector arm, that's drawing $4 billion to the private sector in developing countries that didn't exist before.
The World Bank came out with a report last week that I think would surprise some people because it's not what we think of when we think of the World Bank, but it said that as the world gets wealthier, the amount of waste that is produced around the globe is going to almost double in the next 13 years. Is that something that keeps you up at night in your job?
Well, I sleep pretty well, but maybe it's because I exercise. But I think what that emphasizes is the bank is much more than a bank as a financial institution. It's a research and analytical institution. And one of the things that I've tried to drive forward at the bank is opening up our information, opening up our data sources, and seeing ourselves as part of a broader network to stimulate debate in developed and developing countries. And environmental and conservation issues are a key piece of our work. We've done a lot in biodiversity. We created some special climate investment funds that are helping developing countries pragmatically on the ground. So it reflects the fact that the world economy reaches quite widely, and we need to try to support our client countries as it does so.
Well, I want to ask you about climate change because it's something you've talked a lot about. I've read some of what you've said about it, and the general theme seems to be stop waiting around and do something. Who do you think is holding up progress on climate change?
Well, I'm not really in the blame game. I think what I've been able to see is we're a development institution. You will never deal with the questions of carbon unless you engage developing countries. Many of the negotiations pitted North versus South, which I think was unproductive. So what we've tried to do is, through these climate investment funds, but other things that we've done with countries, to try to show how you can have win-win prospects on energy efficiency, new uses of technology. We've done some investments in alternatives, how to connect this with your transportation systems, adaptation policies, deforestation, where we've made very, very big headway. And the importance of this is it shows real progress on the ground. It draws developing countries into a sense that they're part of the solution. And I hope over time that will bring countries together for the other types of arrangements they need to make. But what I've been critical of is sometimes this idea that, you know, that the real focus of attention is just on getting 195 countries to agree on a text. What we're trying to do is make a difference on the ground.
Do you think that the developed economies of the world right now have an unsustainable standard of living?
No, I'm not an anti-growth advocate. I think that depends on the economies. I think there's going to need to be adjustments in Europe, and I think you've seen with the advent of the euro that there were some countries in the south of Europe that frankly were able to take advantage of that, and they lost the reform drive that they need to take. So my goal is actually to increase developing countries' standard of living, and as they grow, they will be able to buy more from developed countries.
What have you learned about people in the last several years that you've been here at the bank?
Well, I guess that's an ongoing education. Well, I'll say this. We have people from about 170 countries at the bank. We have 188 shareholders. And there's a great challenge, but also great opportunity when you draw people together from different cultures and experiences to try to solve problems in a pragmatic way. I brought in the first chief economist from the developing world. This is Justin Lin, who was from China, but also educated at the University of Chicago. He was a great addition. He and I had different perspectives from our different backgrounds, but part of our role was to stimulate debate, and as I've suggested, he's been one of the big promoters of the need for how developing countries, for example, China, can invest in Africa and manufacturing, and so you can create win-win opportunities. But as the lesson of China has shown, this just won't happen unless you sort of put the fundamentals into some of these structural reforms to make markets work better.
Let me just ask you a couple of final lightning round questions here. If your successors think of one word when they think of your tenure here at the World Bank, what would you like it to be?
Oh, I don't know. Successful.
How many countries have you visited?
Oh, too many to count, but see, I lose count because I was a trade representative and a deputy secretary of state and an undersecretary of state, so I've been to many, and it does give you an interesting perspective. I'm trying to do a little bit more domestic travel in the United States. I haven't done enough of that recently.
Which country has the best food that you've been to?
Oh, that's a tricky one. I think I like my wife's cooking.
That's a good diplomatic answer. What will you miss most about this job?
The range of interesting people dealing with a fascinating set of problems. Again, as we've touched on, the World Bank deals with everything from conflict states like Afghanistan, Liberia, Cote d'Ivoire. It deals with rising powers. It deals with the developed countries that are part of the system, the trade system. So the range of topics, environment, others that you can engage in the bank are truly extraordinary. And the challenge for an executive is, frankly, how you take the talented people at this organization and others and try to make things happen. And I'm very much a believer in that when you have these jobs, your role is not just to kind of sit in the seat and attend the meetings or read the papers, but you try to focus on results. And I've tried to orient the institution in that direction.
Any idea what's next for you? Will we see you in a Romney administration, if there is one?
Well, I've consciously, as I've left the bank, not had discussions in any detail about what I would do next. And so I will probably have an association with a university, and I will probably do some speeches, and I'll decide about politics after I leave.
Robert Zoellick is the president of the World Bank. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
Today, President Obama travels to Cleveland to deliver what's being called a major speech on the economy. The president's been under pressure from Democrats to shake up his economic talking points, which they worry are falling flat with voters. Marketplace's David Gura reports.
Strategists are dusting off their old playbooks, giving President Obama tips on how to tailor his economic message. One camp wants more of this.
I feel your pain.
That line defined Bill Clinton's 92 campaign, and it gave comedians like Phil Hartman fodder for years. Democratic strategist Kelly Bingle is in another camp.
I think you should be focused more on optimism. I mean, I think we need a little bit of morning in America.
It's morning again in America.
Like it's 1984 again.
Under the leadership of President Reagan.
Democratic pollster Anna Greenberg says that right now, President Obama's message is too diffuse, too focused on metrics like jobs numbers and the unemployment rate.
We don't have kind of one narrative about the economy being articulated by either the campaign or the administration.
While a slogan could help, Greenberg says what President Obama needs to do today and right up until Election Day is connect better with middle-class voters. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Mitt Romney says he expects his rival's words in Ohio today to be eloquent, but that, quote, words are cheap. He says the president lacks the ideas and the business background to boost growth and hiring.
In the U.S., federal investigators are expanding their probe into Jeep Grand Cherokees that catch fire. 15 people have died. The investigation covers model years 1993 through 2004. And the American agency that monitors drugs in sports today will bring formal doping charges against legendary cyclist Lance Armstrong. In a statement, Armstrong says, "I have never doped." Lance Armstrong is a central figure in the business of cycling, and his charitable work has brought in millions. Marketplace's Eve Tro has more.
Lance Armstrong is famous for all those Tour de France victories, but he's also famous for beating cancer and raising money for that cause. You know those yellow Livestrong wristbands? Well, they've grown into a multi-million dollar charity that extends well beyond sports, says Catherine McLean with the Lance Armstrong Foundation.
To some people, Livestrong means, you know, perseverance in their quest to quit smoking or their, you know, quest to lose weight.
But Smith College economist Andrew Zimbalist says if the doping charges tarnish the cycling legacy, the charity legacy suffers too.
It's the interaction of those two things that really catapulted Lance Armstrong's brand. What Lance Armstrong was and what he represented as a human who had transcended previously conceived human limitations, I think that that's gone.
Armstrong insists the charges are false. Zimbalist says that gives fans of his charity and his cycling something to hold on to. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
This week, Bank of America promised to spend $50 billion over 10 years to invest in renewable energy and alternative transportation. Goldman Sachs and Wells Fargo now have big green pledges as well. The New York Times suggests this is a way for Wall Street to burnish its tarnished image. But But here's an additional explanation. Maybe the giants are following the lead of a small bank in San Francisco that's been doing what it calls Planet Smart Banking for years. Vincent Siciliano is president and CEO of New Resource Bank. Mr. Siciliano, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Help me understand. You're building an organic, hormone-free, non-GMO bank?
Well, I would say we're building a bank that takes a broader look at business and society and tries to integrate our values into what we do.
So if a potential customer feels they're sick and tired with their traditional bank and they come to you and they put some money on deposit, how might you use it in this different way?
Well, we have a number of sectors. So, for example, the area that we call clean technology, which would include companies that are involved in solar energy, energy efficiency, that would be an area that we're quite involved with. We work with a lot of nonprofits. We also work with real estate that is building buildings in a different way.
I mean, that's the real power of an institution like yours, in that you can give people loans and you can decide in which direction to direct them, and you want to do business with people who are thinking longer term.
Yes, I think one of the problems in our system is that we discount everything. We discount the future to the present, and that very quickly removes any real value of the future when we're making our decisions now. And we have to get away from that. I understand the economic need to look for appropriate financial returns, but we can't pretend that the future of our grandchildren really has no value today.
Smaller banks, unfortunately, have not been immune from the effects of the banking crisis. Does your size make you, do you think, more vulnerable to financial shocks or the continued, what should we call it, brittleness of the U.S. economy?
Well, right now, frankly, we're seeing pretty strong loan demand. The Bay Area is doing pretty well, both because of its technology base, but also because there is a strong interest in companies that are managing from a more sustainable perspective. We think over the long run, we're going to see companies that are more resilient to economic shocks, that are more attractive to employees, that have a better brand value. So I think we're beginning to see that unfold already, that sustainably minded businesses are going to do better.
Vincent Siciliano, President and CEO of New Resource Bank in San Francisco, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Any day now, the bulletin will hit that has the words Supreme Court, healthcare reform, and either the words constitutional or unconstitutional.
And the latest poll numbers suggest margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
Healthcare reform and public opinion, the subject of Attitude Check, our weekly partnership with Gallup. Let's welcome Frank Newport, Gallup's editor-in-chief.
Good morning.
So, White House has said that even if polls showed unease with its healthcare reform, that Americans would grow to love it. Has that happened?
No, it has not. It's been over 2 years so far. I just reviewed a lot of polling which has been done on the Health Care Act, and no matter how it is explained to Americans now, in general, with the few exceptions, we have more negative than positive response on the part of the average American. In some polls, the spread is up to 10 points or more. That is, Americans saying they dislike rather than like the Affordable Care Act that was passed back in 2010.
Okay, that's broad brush, but if you ask Americans, okay, so what don't you like about it, or what do you like about it, what do you hear?
We see this in policy and some other instances as well. The Americans actually like components of the Health Care Act. For example, they like the idea that people with pre-existing conditions cannot be denied coverage. They like the idea that kids can ride on their parents' policies. The one thing they do not like, and this is almost universal in all the polling I've seen, is the individual mandate. That's the requirement, and actually the core of the whole thing, that all Americans have to get health care coverage to make the whole thing affordable.
But what does your reading of all this data suggest about how Americans might react to the Supreme Court decision expected this very month?
Now, I think if the Supreme Court lets it stand, we'll actually have a negative reaction from Americans, because as we've been talking about, Americans actually are more negative than positive about the act, particularly about the individual mandate. If the Supreme Court strikes down the mandate but lets the rest stand, that actually would comport most closely, I think, with American public opinion. And, of course, since we're in an election cycle, everybody asks us, well, how will this affect Obama and Romney's chances? And, boy, that's a complex question, but I don't think we know yet. We're going to have to wait and see how it plays out once the decision comes down.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief of Gallup, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Well, David, did you see the owner of the Billionaire Club in Italy, in Sardinia, has said he's closing up shop after more than 10 years. According to the Telegraph newspaper, Flavio Briatore is shutting the doors of his seaside resort where the rich and famous can sip champagne and party. He says his next venture is to become Italy's Donald Trump, hosting a local version of The Apprentice.
All right. That is a life goal, isn't it, being Trump? And finally, technology is everywhere. And earlier this spring, I drove from the Atlantic to the Pacific to see if I could do it dealing only with machines and no humans. Robot check-in kiosks at hotels were part of this. But I should have waited a couple of weeks. Coming to our shores now, a pizza vending machine. Finally, it kneads the dough, rolls it out, and cooks the pie in 3 minutes. 200 possible toppings, just press the buttons. They're calling it Let's Pizza, but may I humbly suggest Doughbot.
See, David, one day I'm going to see you on commercials for Doughbot. I just guarantee it right now. That's a brilliant idea.
I'm there in New York. I'm David Brancaccio.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.